You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is August 1st, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. And we are live from the first all-digital Nexus.
Yay! Are people clapping out there?
Virtual claps, please.
Joining me, as always, are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy! I'm in Kara. Spice.
You're a spice girl.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Edmund Bernstein.
Hello, hello, hello.
And our special guest, George Robb.
Hi. Him. George. Oh, no, not him again.
Got a question.
Yes.
How's my collar? I haven't worn a collar in months.
I know, right, Bob?
Is it okay? Am I wearing it right?
You're having collar anxiety?
Collar anxiety.
With everything going on right now, you're having collar anxiety.
It's just That's one the of the most many pressing, anxieties.
The most pressing issue, it's fine. So, yeah, thank you to do that. This is cool, man. This is like, you know, we first realized that we were getting to that point where it was like a go-no-go, like a NASA go-no-go, right? Like either we are going to book a hotel for Nexus 2020 and fully commit, or we were going to have to cancel it. And we decided to, instead of canceling it, we would go all digital. We would do a digital Nexus. And then once that idea was sort of put forward, it was pretty obvious that that was the way to go, right? So yeah, we just canceled all plans for a live show. Because this is even in the early days of the pandemic. We basically said, we have no idea, right? Back in March, early March, we have no idea what the pandemic is going to be like in July and August. And I think that was a good call, right? Not because, this would not be the time to do an in-person mass gathering. So that was definitely a good call. In fact, Jay and I were just talking about the fact that, we don't know when it's going to be a good call for next year. I mean, we were planning on doing a live event next year, but who knows, So we're just to give you a heads up, we're toying with just doing another digital conference next year and putting off the next live conference to 2022.
Well, think about it.
We haven't decided anything yet. We've got to keep an eye on this pandemic.
Let me throw the parameters out to you guys. So the problem is, when's the vaccine going to come?
Right.
Maybe January? When will everybody gain access to the vaccine?
When and if and how
January,
effective?
January, February, March. So July isn't really that far away from January. Yeah. So we just don't know if we're going to be doing anything in person next year.
Mm-hmm. I know. We've had to cancel all of our extravaganza events for this year. I know George openly wept when that happened.
Openly.
Openly, yeah.
This is more than made up for.
Yeah.
Look into the camera because I want to get your reaction. I was just told we have 1,500 registrants for Nexus.
Whoa, 1,500.
Evan, what did I just tell you upstairs?
I thought that was saying 15 minutes. I'm like, 15 minutes till what?
If I'm interpreting that number right, Ian's holding up. Yes?
Awesome.
Yeah, nicely done.
So it's also the biggest Nexus that's ever happened. So the first Nexus was in 2009.
Are you sure?
Remember?
That was the smallest one.
We have a Wikipedia entry, George.
Ooh, nice. Okay, awesome.
So if Wikipedia is correct, it was 2009. I still remember when Michael Feldman and I were sitting at dinner amongst a big crowd of New England skeptical people and New York City skeptical people and SGU people. And we had a local event right in New York, but it wasn't Nexus yet. It was just we did a live show and some things around it. And Michael and I had a conversation about we should do a conference. We should just take this little nugget that we have and parlay this into a skeptical conference.
That was the Perry DeAngelis.
It was just the Perry DeAngelis Memorial SGU episode that we did live in New York, again, with a couple of guest speakers. But we parlayed that into Nexus. And here we are. This is the 12th Nexus. This is the first digital Nexus, but the 12th Nexus overall. There are a few good things that have come out of this pandemic in my personal experience, and I think this is one of those things. There's still something you said for a live, conference, getting together, all the socializing before and after. Here we are literally in our undisclosed location. It's obviously a small studio, but still, we're connecting with 1,500 people. We've been having great speakers. We have Kara connecting with us from Scotland, or some random place in space.
Space.
Scotland space.
Spartari Nebula.
And yeah, it's been fantastic. The other good thing from, again, for me professionally was telehealth. You know, like, and we're going to have a telemental health panel later, I think right after our show, or after the quiz after our show. It was like, this was something we've been talking about. It's been hard to make happen. There's been resistance and people weren't sure if it was going to work. And then it instantly happened. It's like the pandemic hit and it's like, well, I guess we're doing telehealth because we're doing telehealth or nothing.
Yep.
And it's been fantastic.
People love it, right?
People
prefer it.
People love it. Wow. I mean, you know, it's not good when you're forced to do it on everyone because it's not optimal for people who need a lot of examination, like in-person exam, or for people who are not tech savvy enough to like do a video chat, you know. But for most patients, I mean, I think I've said this on the show before, but think about it. Like, if I'm seeing a follow-up migraine patient, I literally need a 10-minute conversation with them about their medications, their migraines, how everything's going on, give them their refills, et cetera. They could, you know, imagine the rigmarole that they have to go through for that 10-minute in-person conversation with me, including fighting traffic, getting into the clinic, getting checked in, waiting in the waiting room with 20 other people.
Yeah, it's healthier.
Yeah, and then they get the meeting, then they have to check out, then they have to go home, fighting traffic again probably. And now we just cut all of that out and we have just a 10-minute conversation directly.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. The even though our clinic has opened, we're still doing a lot of telehealth visits. And my commute is so much better than it used to. Even now, even though Connecticut is doing well and we're pretty much open.
You mean because less traffic?
There's no traffic.
Yeah.
There's no traffic.
Yeah.
I'm going just right into work in the middle of New Haven.
I mean, let's face it. For doctors, it makes so much sense, right? For all the health reasons. But, you know, I've talked to dozens of people who have been working from home, and it's working.
Yeah.
We're burning less fossil fuels. People don't have to waste the time of the commute, right, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you remember, you would be like, I'm wasting 2 hours a day just going.
Yeah, I'm down here, Jay.
Oh, sorry.
There's a good chunk of doctoring is hands-on. So why can't they send a robot to your house to give you the enema or whatever you need?
A shot.
How close are we to
enema.
Robots?
I love Bob goes right to robot
the
enema.
Animatronic 2000.
Right to robot
enema. They did that
enema.
In Star Wars. They stuck a needle on a big probe droid thing and sent it into the cell and jab Leo.
I hate not knowing if people are laughing. We need a laugh track. A live laugh track.
Bob,
that we can hear to get feedback and feel good.
I know. I was introducing you guys, and I'm instinctively waiting for the applause. Like, nothing's happening. There's no applause. I guess I just keep going.
At least there's an upside. At least I don't have to hear me get the least applause of anybody.
I know.
That's
right.
Really good.
Bob, you know what?
Bob, your collar is fine.
What?
Bob has collars.
Yes, Bob. Your collar's fantastic.
Oh,
man.
I feel so
Absolutely.
Good now.
Let's hear it for Bob. In the comments, please, everyone, just say heart, collar, Bob.
Yes.
That's the point.
I'm not wearing a belt.
Hashtag no belt, collar, heart.
I haven't worn a belt
in 3 months. So much has changed since the pandemic started. What we're used to has changed.
Yeah.
Like, just even our sleep patterns are different. I've been wearing shorts. I'm not typically a short wearing person. I always wear blue jeans for some reason. I never was a guy that just got up and put shorts on. I have been wearing shorts more in the last 4 months, 5 months of my life than the previous 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this I consider this a good thing. I love it.
That's the best thing to come out of the pandemic is
Jay's knees.
One of the minor
Jay's
belts.
Breathable knees. It's the best
Jay.
Part of the pandemic. How many shorts do you own, Jay?
Own like 5 pairs of shorts.
5 pairs of shorts. All right.
How about you?
I have one pair. I have 2 pairs of shorts that I literally bought, I think, in 1991. They're like hiking shorts. They have like big pockets, and I only wear them when I go hiking. It's the only time I wear those shorts.
George, I've seen you wear shorts in the 12 years I've known you once.
Where were we?
It was at Bob's birthday party in the middle of the summer.
It wasn't pretty.
I didn't wear shorts. You are fabricating that. There's no way
exactly.
I wore shorts. There's no way. Yeah, you fabricated.
Was there swimming?
There's no. Yeah, there was swimming, but I was not wearing swim trunks. Yeah, no. There's no. Yeah, you've totally believe me. I would.
You just don't wear shorts?
I just don't wear shorts. No, I just don't. I mean, for like jogging and hiking, but
what about when you work out?
Yeah, for jogging or whatever.
So, but George, though, to get a little bit more serious, so. There are downsides to the pandemic, obviously. We're not trying to make light of all the economic pain
Of course.
That's been going on, obviously. And you are a live performer, right?
Yes.
This has got to be crushing you.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It has to be.
I mean, the curious thing, and I've talked about this already, luckily this has been fixed in the meantime because I had a gig with my band, my funk band, the Philadelphia Funk Authority. We had a gig on a beach at a beach club that was very smart. They were temperature checking everybody, social distancing. We were facing the water. We weren't facing the club to encourage people to spread out on the thing. Mostly nobody was there, so we were kind of just ignored for 2 hours. But it was kind of nice because we had...
So it was like a typical concert.
It's like a typical George Robb performance, pretty much. Yeah, just people on the beach going like, what? Why? But
I can't hear you over the noise.
I'm listening to the waves. Could you just tone it down a little bit? But it was nice because we hadn't played in 5 months. And I got to this point where I realized that was literally the longest time in my life since I was 3 years old of not performing in front of an audience, because I went to a musical preschool. So at the age of four, every 6 weeks we had a concert. All through grade school and high school, I was in band, I was in choir, I was in chorus, all that. And then in college, obviously, and then after college, I never went for 5 months without playing in front of people. So it was this strange kind of corkscrew in my soul that was just like, you know, I did some online stuff, of course, but it's so different. Luckily, you know, having podcasted forever, which is an interesting thing that I think we all sort of are capable of, is the fact that you're talking to nobody, in essence. Mm-hmm. You know, especially for me, for a solo show, you guys are kind of chatting with each other.
Yeah.
But for me, as a solo podcasting guy who's just with a microphone and that's it, the idea of not having a response, which doesn't even come when there are people there, but the idea of having no response because there are no people, you sort of get used to. So now when I'm having a guitar, or I'm doing my series of 13 songs, which is every 2 weeks on YouTube, you know, you finish the tune and you just hope. I think people liked it.
Yeah.
Hopefully,
you
look at the chat later on or whatever. But it's
hearts floating up.
Yeah. You hope for some kind of a little thing. Yeah. And in an odd way, I actually love the chat aspect of it. That people can, during a performance, like what's happening right now, during the performance, people can talk to each other, and it's not interrupting the performance.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Oh, it's so great. Wow. Or you can get this thing of like, and it's not in a bar where people are like, this guy's really good, or this guy stinks. It's like nothing like, or like, what's the special again? Is it fries? Come with the, you know, like that's what's usually happening behind when I'm trying to play a tune. And now you get this lovely interaction, which I go back to afterwards and kind of scroll through and watch. And it's like, oh, okay, people seem to be enjoying it.
I mean, so George, that's a lovely last bonus. Night at the game show, we were talking afterwards, and we were discussing like how active the chat was during the game show. And my point was, which Bob completely shot out of my head, was that the chat was its own source of entertainment along with the game show, which I thought was like, oh, my God, it like just turned into like a 3D kind of interaction with the audience.
And by the way, let me say, if we're ever in a life-and-death situation – requiring knowledge of movie trivia, let's make sure that Bill Nye and Leanne Lord and Andrea Jones-Roy are nowhere near us.
Because
I don't think they guessed one of the movie quotes.
Wow.
They got a couple of them. All right, so in our defense.
I got it them all.
You're making a defense.
No, in our defense, so listen, so the game show was great, but we wrote all of the clues and the games ourselves out of nothing. We've never play tested them before. So in the process of doing that, we sort of play tested the difficulty of the clues on each other.
Yep.
And in retrospect, that may not have been a representative population to play test. Because we're like movie quotes.
Lots of people were answering.
Oh yeah, there were 1,200 people on the chat though, Evan. So,
yeah, you're right.
Yes, if you crowdsource it, of course someone's going to
get the answer. 10 people on average guessed every question and they typed it in. It looks like everybody knows every answer.
Yeah,
I can't get out of my head.
So it might be a little bit harder than we expected.
I'm still thinking of George. Sorry, God. I'm still thinking of George going to musical preschool with his little like ukulele guitar as big as him and his drum set. I just got that fun image of it. You know, I went to a quantum mechanics preschool.
Oh, nice.
Well, I failed out. I just couldn't grasp the quantum tunneling and superposition.
Yeah. It was a Ukrainian musical preschool. Pani Martha, Miss Martha's preschool.
Pani Martha.
She was amazing. She had this great thing where she would lay out on the floor. She had this gigantic clear vinyl mat. and it had the lines of music on it. Mm-hmm. So you would like, you would be a C, or you would be a D sharp, or you would be a what, and it would just be lying on the floor. And that's how she taught us this idea of how notes work and how staff works. And, I played in one of the things. I remember being like a gnome who sneaks up on a squirrel, and I scare her and she loses all of her nuts. And then I feel bad, and then I put all the nuts back. And it's all like with dancing in the, yeah, it's burned into my brain.
It's a false memory, almost.
I'm sure, totally. Yeah. My parents are like, no, you never went to that.
Pictures might be right, though.
So what's interesting, like I'm rounding in the hospital the last couple of weeks. I'm on the inpatient service. So I'm rounding with a big team. We're all wearing masks. We all have to get gowned into pretty much every room that we go into, or for a lot of them. And you know, all the conference, all you know, those
strapless, those sequins,
paper disposable gowns that you have to put on. You know, the center of the conversation was, this could be our new normal, right? Like, we may never go back to what it was like 6 months ago. This is for in medicine, at least. I doubt that we're ever going to go back, and that's been the progress over my career. Every time some new extra layer of protection for microorganisms or infections is introduced, that's the new normal. It never goes back. So I think that's but hopefully that will be true of all the good things that we're figuring out how to do as well, like digital conferences and doing more stuff online. We're doing a live thing every Friday that we weren't doing before, and it's been a great experience. I don't know if we're going to be able to, how long we're going to be able to keep doing it, what that will morph into, but I just think that we're making the best of the situation. I think that some innovative good things will come out of it.
I just hope that the people who employ thousands, I guess any company, let your people work from home.
They're going to.
Yeah.
Just do it. It's better for everyone. Not only is it healthier, but it saves you money. It saves them money.
The overhead costs come down. That's what goes.
Yeah,
down.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That's pretty much all right. The bottom line.
Let's go on to some segments in the show. Kara, you're actually going to start us off on the formal segments with a what's the word?
It just kills me even looking at it. Okay. So as we all know, the Perseverance rover was just sent to Mars. And every time I see the word perseverance, I pronounce it perseverance. And I'll tell you exactly why. It's because there is an important concept in neuroscience, neuropsychology, neurology called perseveration. So I'm actually going to talk about four different forms of a word that all have the same root today. So let's go through them one by one. Yeah, four. So persevere. We're all used to that word, persevere. Yes. So to persevere in something is to persist, to stick it out, to pursue that course. And this comes from like a 14th century French term, persevere. And, this is kind of the main root that we're all pretty comfortable with. And then we move on to what the rover is named for, perseverance. I have to stop myself every time. Which is the noun form, right? So this is the will or the ability to persevere. This actually comes from a root that's a little bit older, but still 12th century to 14th century French, which may have even come from a Latin stem. But now we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about, because I don't think I need to define perseverance, right? I mean, I just did, but we don't need anything deeper than that, do we? No, we're pretty comfortable.
We could,
Okay. Yeah. The concept of perseveration, or to perseverate, or to be perseverative. There are a lot of different forms of this word. So perseveration, which is spelled, as you can see, the same freaking way, which is confusing, but there's a reason for etymological purposes. Perseveration is the tendency to continue with some sort of response even after the stimulus has been removed. And one of the best ways that I like to describe this has to do with, let's say we're doing a neuropsychological assessment of an individual who has a frontal lobe disorder. So they've had a stroke or they've had some sort of organic injury to the brain, and their frontal lobe, they're showing some dysfunction in their frontal lobe functioning. So there's a really famous test called the Wisconsin Card Sort Test. There are also famous tests like the Trail Making Test. And in these, you'll tell the person, I'm going to do a series of tasks. Let's say I'm going to put down cards in a particular order, and then I want you to finish the sequence. Okay, no harm, no foul. I put down card one, card two, card three. Then they add card four, card five, card six. But
person,
then I might
man,
say,
man, TV,
Yes, exactly.
Sorry.
Perfect, George. But then I might say, now I'm going to give you a new task. It might use the same rules as the old one or totally new rules. And then I might start putting down the cards in this order. 2, 4, 6, 8. But the person might, after 8, say 9, 10, 11, 12. They are perseverating on the original stimulus. They're having a hard time switching tasks in order to utilize some sort of new stimulus. And usually we think of it as verbal. It can actually be in other modalities as well, but verbal is one of the ones that we typically test for in a neuropsych setting.
So you're talking about the neuropsychological testing, which is designed to pick out subtle versions of perseveration.
Like I'm talking about not a real life example.
Yeah, so but I see real life examples every day where people have significant brain damage. And so I see the other end of the spectrum. I see the whole spectrum, but I do see people all the way to the other end of the spectrum. So even just in the past week, for example, like there were a patient, for example, you say, so what is the date? And they said 11/20. Which is actually their birthday. And they said, what year is it, 11/20? Where are we, 11/20? What's your name, 11/20? Like they were completely perseverating on some question somebody had asked them. And no matter what question we asked, they persisted.
Wait, but Steve, they could have tapped into like an alien language and been trying to communicate important information to you.
That's possible. I didn't
Occam's
immediately
razor.
Think of
Jay,
and
Occam's razor.
Hypothesis. So, but and you want to know what the end stage is? Like the most significant manifestation is you have a patient draw a circle, right? You have them draw a circle on a piece of paper, and this is what they do. Just draw a circle, and they just do this. They can't stop. They just keep going.
Why?
Yeah.
Because they're perseverating. So that part of your brain that enables the frontal lobes, that enables you to stop, to go, to switch strategy, to alter your rule is not working. And so once they start doing something, they're in a groove. That's it. They just keep going and going and going and going.
I mean, is it something short or could it be a complicated series of tasks?
So it can't be so complicated that they have to be in any way nimble. Like they can't switch what they're doing, right? So if you tell them something that they could do, which they're basically able to keep in their working memory all at one time.
So it's like fidgety kind of almost.
No, it's not fidgety. It's completely different.
I'm sorry. I just want to be clear.
All right.
Like, you know, like when you're – like when I use Photoshop, I have to do like 5 or 7 things in the same order every time I want to like save a picture. I'm doing the same things to it. And each one of those things takes about, say, 30 seconds to do all of those tasks. Mm-hmm. Would they do that, like something that lasts 30 seconds or something that lasts a minute? Or does it have to be something really quick? Like
no, it's very quick.
Okay.
It's usually the thing
the thing that they're immediately doing.
And it requires, you know, whatever it is, there's a strategy. So Steve was talking about the most extreme example. I was talking about a more subtle example. And there are, of course, examples in between. So let's say that somebody who has a frontal lobe disorder is working on their house and they're, you know, let's say like it's a husband and a wife and the wife says, hey, honey, can you paint this? And then he'll start painting. And then she might say, okay, now I want to hang these hooks, but then he's trying to paint them still. Like it's a very difficult thing to switch to a new task. Mm-hmm. And so it's somewhere in between, right? Like the really severe example, like Steve was saying, you're right. They'll either be doing this or they'll say like a series of letters or words over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And it's just, that's their world. But it can also become more like somebody who's actually higher functioning might just have a hard time switching gears. And you might have even met people who do this where they don't seem to understand a new set of instructions because they're still trying to do it the old way. But you're like, no, that won't work now. We've moved on to step two. But they're still trying to do it the way they would have in step one. That's another example of perseveration. So when we look at the etymology, of course, of perseveration and of, you know, the other words perseverate, things like that, they're actually, they go to the same roots, but of course, in a psychological sense, the first use of perseveration, I think, this is really cool, was in 1903 in Germany. But the first use of the word perseverate was actually, I love this, it was actually a back formation from perseveration. So it's like the word gets kind of coined, and then you start to see all of the different forms of that word. Sometimes they're not used for years, and they're based on the word that was coined. So eventually it becomes such a big part of your vernacular that, for example, I find myself having a hard time when I see the word perseverance or persevere, because I always want to say perseverance.
Yes.
Oh, it's so frustrating. Yeah.
Is there medication for this, Steve? Any treatment, or are you just wired that way?
You mean for Carol?
Yeah, there is. I mean, not a great effect, but if you use a stimulant, it can help the frontal lobes work a little bit more robustly and may diminish these kinds of symptoms. So,
right, and you may even see some slight perseverative symptoms in people with other types of frontal lobe disorders or things that have frontal lobe function implicated, like OCD, like ADHD.
Yeah.
You might actually see higher rates of certain types of perseverative behaviors. And, of course, stimulant treatments are common, at least for ADHD, and it can actually help with some of that as well.
Cool. All right, thanks, Kara. Bob.
Yeah. Yep.
Your number's up, sir.
Yes, we haven't done one of these in a while, so welcome to Bob, your number's up. This number is one of my favorite. It's a zero. I'll tell you right now. It's a zero. It's one of my favorite zeros, but it's not the zero between negative one and one. It's another type of zero. It's a cool zero, but in fact, it's not just cool. It's the coldest zero in existence. It's absolute zero.
Yes.
And, that number is, compared to other numbering systems or temperature systems, -273.15 Celsius. It's -459.67 Fahrenheit. So that's damn cold, or more simply, zero Kelvin. The origin of the concept of absolute zero, I think, started with a gentleman named Guillaume Amontons, who's a French inventor. He kind of brought us up really close to the modern conception of what absolute zero is. But it took Sir William Thompson, or Lord Kelvin, which is such an awesome name, Lord Kelvin, to really bring us the rest of the way to this modern conception of what absolute zero is. So what is absolute zero? It's as cold as you can get. You can't get any colder than absolute zero. And it's a wall. I mean, there's nothing beyond it. There is no -1 Kelvin, right? It's just that concept is not just wrong. It's meaningless. It's like, what happened before the Big Bang?
But, doesn't it mean that nothing is moving? There is no energy transfer.
Well, Jay, that's a common misconception that I had not 20 minutes ago.
talking about it with Steve.
You fool. You fool.
But to understand it, Jay, I'll get there in a second, but to understand it or to better appreciate it, I think you got to think about what exactly is temperature. Temperature, one of the more accurate way to describe what temperature is the average kinetic energy of atoms. And as things get colder, that average jittering of atoms calms down and gets less and less and less. And at absolute zero, it is at a minimum amount of jitteriness. It's actually very similar to the speed of light. When you consider moving at the speed of light, if you're mass can never get to the speed of light. You, as Carl Sagan used to say, you could mount the decimals towards the speed of light, 99.999% the speed of light and farther. But you can never quite reach the speed of light because you would need infinite energy. Well, it's the same for absolute zero. You can never get to absolute zero because it would take more and more energy to extract those little bits, those little tenuous bits of heat that are still there that you're trying to extract. And like getting to the speed of light, eventually you would need to do infinite work in order to get it down to absolute
zero. So it's a concept only?
Is it theoretical?
I mean, yes, it's theoretical. We've never reached it and we never will reach it for these reasons, just like we haven't reached the speed of light, but we're pretty damn solid on this.
Where the analogy breaks down is though that things that have no mass can go at the speed of light.
Right.
But there's no equivalent of that with absolute zero because everything is stuff, right? I mean, there's just nothing that doesn't take infinite energy to get to absolute zero.
Right. Yeah. And the reason why, I mean, you can never have true cessation of any of that atomic jittering because of quantum mechanics. And, you know, you got to listen to quantum mechanics. Whatever that says, you kind of have to like, okay, I just accept that. And there's multiple ways to look at it. One way is to look at Heisenberg's uncertainty, indeterminacy. Yes, quite certain. You know, you can't know, as you know position, you can know momentum less accurately and vice versa. So you can never know precisely position and momentum. So there's always going to be some irreducible amount of jittering in those atoms, which is what happens at absolute zero, which we can never reach. So guys, how close have we gotten to absolute zero?
Pretty close.
This is really cool.
Absolutely.
The closest we've ever gotten in 2003, MIT recorded 4-5 nanokelvin, a billionth of a degree. That's a half of a billionth of a degree above absolute zero. Super, super close. Never going to really get there, but we're just getting closer and closer.
How did they achieve that?
Wait, but that was 15 whole years ago?
I know.
Why haven't we made any more progress?
Because
of
that's
warming. It's different time.
Global warming. Kara, that just goes to show how difficult this is and how when we get this close, these little incremental advances are going to be harder.
Wait, Bob, this is kind of a stupid question, maybe. Was there ever a time in the history of the universe, like, is this like pre-Big Bang is equivalent to absolute zero? Is that the only time it would have ever been cosmologically achieved?
I'd say no. I mean, we live in a quantum mechanical universe, so you would have to get outside that universe to make that happen.
Right, so maybe before the Big Bang.
There's no matter.
Before the Big Bang, I don't think temperature existed, right? I mean, we don't know, but it just seems to make sense.
There's no matter, there's no thing to get cold.
Yeah, I mean, you could talk about before the Big Bang, but it's difficult because time started with the Big Bang, so pre-Big Bang means before time, but how could anything happen if there's no
land before time?
Don't get me started on that. So, but just so you have an idea, I mean, I talked about a half a billionth. We got down to a half a billionth of a degree. How cold is that? That's a million times colder than outer space. Think about that. Space is pretty cold. This is on Earth. We've got a million times colder than that.
Maybe they just figured that. That's good enough, right?
No. Science, Steve. This is science. Stop it.
Bob, do you know how big of an area they made that cold? Like, was it the size of a marble? Was it the size of a...
Oh, super tiny, super tiny. I don't have the dimensions, but crazy, crazy small.
It was the size of the difference in the hotel shower between freezing and scalding hot.
Exactly. Yes.
It was that size.
So here's another way to look at it. In this room right now, the atoms are moving approximately at the speed of a jet engine.
Mm-hmm. I would think more of the speed of a fart.
A jet engine. But at this temperature...
Wait, what do you mean at the speed? What's moving at the speed of a jet engine?
The atoms in the atmosphere that you're breathing right now are jostling around and hitting and careening off each other and jittering that fast.
How come we don't hear that?
Jay, I'm doing a shell example.
Next to your ear. You'll hear it. It's going to be okay because if you, at this half a billionth of a degree, Jay, when it's moving, let's say, 2 inches per minute. Ah. So from a jet engine to 2 inches per minute. Isn't that cool, Jay?
That's awesome.
All right, Jay. So let's see. Now, you may read that we got even colder than that. Some people say that we got to 1/10 of a billionth of a degree. And we kind of did in another experiment.
That happened during one of my friend's marriages.
Yeah. I've heard of that. I've heard that happen.
That's fake temperature.
So that was an interesting experiment as well, but it wasn't exactly the same. They were measuring one particular type of nuclear spin, so it's not quite apples to apples scenario. So in the future, let's talk about the future, which of course I love thinking about. So in the future, you're not going to be hearing about nanokelvins. It's going to be more about picokelvins because we're pretty much there right now. We're 500 or 450 picokelvins right now. So in the past, we've gone through, in our lifetime, I think, I remember when we were down to 1 Kelvin, 2 Kelvin, that was really good. But then it got to millikelvin, which is 1,000. Then micro, nano, pico. In the future, if we ever get there, and this could be decades away before we even start to even hear about this, but there's also femtokelvin, which is a quadrillion of a degree.
Kelvin.
And what's that?
Harpo Kelvin, Groucho Kelvin.
Harpo
Kelvins are very quiet, so you can't quite make them out.
I'm not trying to be dismissive because I've always found absolute zero a cool concept. It's one of the things about science. You know, you find out about, oh, cool, you never forget it. But why do we care?
All right, this is why we care, Jay, because...
are we cooling our beverages with the absolute... Like, what are we using absolute zero?
Because look, when we got down to, like, very low Kelvins, like, say, 1, 2, or 3 Kelvin, we discovered that gases can become superfluid. You know what a superfluid is? Jay, imagine you have a glass of water, and the water climbs up the glass and goes out. I mean, it does crazy counterintuitive stuff. It's akin to like superconductivity.
Yeah.
These are amazing physical manifestations that are just completely counterintuitive. And when you get down to the nanokelvin, say in the nanokelvin, billionths of a degree, you have Bose-Einstein condensates where you get like a cloud of gas atoms that behave as one atom. You could have 100 atoms, Jay, that behave all as one, like super
atom. So there might be properties with that you know, there might be something it does that's incredible.
Well, it's all about learning new physics, right, Bob?
Right.
It's all about learning new physics.
And, Dave, these aren't lab curiosities. There are potentially amazing applications to this, to superfluids and Bose-Einstein condensates, you know, supercomputing, all sorts of things that we could apply to. So my point in mentioning getting down to, like, say, one attokelvin, mm-hmm. which is a quintillionth of a degree, above absolute zero. Who knows what's going to, you know, we have ideas, but we could see some manifestation of physics that, wow, we could use this for something. Like for, here's an example, Jay. I had one zeptokelvin. One zeptokelvin. That, and Jay, you're going to like,
pretty close,
Jay, you're going to like this number. This is one sextillionth of a degree above absolute zero. One sextillionth of a degree.
Okay.
At that, it's theorized that at that temperature, when we finally get down that low, macroscopic tunneling can occur.
Oh, wow.
Macroscopic tunneling. Who knows?
Who knows?
Jay, look it up. Look up quantum tunneling. It's fascinating stuff.
I don't have time for that.
Well, I'm just saying that crazy stuff could happen, and it's, Jay, crazy stuff can happen, and we don't know, all right?
Thank you.
All right. The film, The Fifth Element, you know, which is a wonderful film, and I could deal with the lousy space travel. I could deal with the taxi cabs flying around. I could deal with the crazy, you know, futuristic outfits and all that stuff. I could deal with the clone having all of knowledge of the world implanted into her brain instantly. But at one point, when they're looking at a satellite or some kind of a thing, and they said it's 5,000 degrees above zero on one side and 5,000 degrees below zero on the other, I was like, I'm out. That's it. Yeah. I'm done. There's no 5,000 degrees below zero.
That did it for you.
That did it for me.
Okay.
Well, but hang on. They said degrees. They said degrees.
What's the scale? Yeah, but
Kelvin doesn't have degrees. It's not degrees. It's not 2 degrees Kelvin. It's 2 Kelvin.
2 Kelvin, right.
You could say 2 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Fahrenheit. But not, so if they said degrees, it by definition wasn't the Kelvin scale.
I think they say Fahrenheit or Celsius. I think there was an actual, right. Chat people
confirmed
what they said.
Wrong in detail. All right, let's move on.
I got my tagline, Steve.
Yeah, hit
this was Bob. Your number's up. I hope you enjoyed it more than when your number's up. Thanks, Steve.
Wouldn't want to miss that. Okay.
Hey, man, it's part of the script.
So we've spoken on the show before about climate sensitivity. George, can you give me a technical definition of climate sensitivity, please?
Yeah, it's when you first wake up and then, like, you know, you pull the sheet down and it's like the air conditioner has been pumping all night, and then you get that sort of like that happens there because you've been sort of surprised.
Yeah, that's one definition, yeah. There's another one that goes like this, that climate sensitivity is the increase in average global temperature that would result from a doubling of pre-industrial carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Got it?
Okay. Or that.
It's basically how much will the Earth warm when we increase CO2? Like, where's the curve? Mm-hmm. But it specifically just marks it at, you know, just to have a number to talk about, at a doubling of pre-industrial levels. The reason why we talk about climate sensitivity is because if you are an even slightly sophisticated climate change denier, this is what you talk about. You say, all right, yes, global temperatures go up when you increase CO2. Sure. Mm-hmm. But climate sensitivity is so low. How low is it? It's so low that it doesn't matter. Yeah. That we could just pump tons of CO2 into the atmosphere and it would have an insignificant effect on average global temperatures. So the question is, for scientists, what is the climate sensitivity? How much is the globe going to warm? Now, you might think that we have a very precise answer to that question.
No, I wouldn't.
But we don't.
It's complicated.
We don't. There's a range. Now, the graph that we're showing for those who are watching on Facebook or on the stream or whatever is from a recent paper where they did a systematic review of all the research on climate sensitivity in an attempt to revise the range estimate. Now, you may be surprised to know that up until this paper, but even, you know, basically the current standard of, like, what is the climate sensitivity, the accepted range, was essentially developed in the 1970s. And for the last 50 years, that's basically been the answer.
It's a bit outdated, is what you're saying?
Yeah, no, definitely outdated. It's just hard to model the changes sufficiently to narrow the confidence interval. Yeah. So that the range has been between 2 and 5 degrees, right? Between 2 and 5 degrees, mm-hmm. So Celsius. But the goal, of course, we want to be able to narrow that range. So we could say worst case scenario when we double CO2, the globe is going to be 5 degrees warmer than pre-industrial level. But the climate change denier would go, no, it's not. It's only going to be 1 degree warmer. It's going to be at the other end of that probability curve. But they're actually also pushing numbers that are lower than even the low end of the estimates. You know, they're saying that the 2, which is kind of the low end of the estimate, is even too high. It's really going to be 1. But whatever. And even 2 could be potentially bad. But, you know, the difference between 2 degrees and 5 degrees net warming, you know, for a doubling of the CO2 is huge in terms of the implications, the climate implications. Yeah. It's huge. And so a lot of the uncertainty in terms of, like, what are things going to look like in 2100? Like, how much sea level rise are we going to have? It's all based upon the uncertainty and the climate sensitivity, or a lot of it is. There's other reasons for uncertainty, like exactly how the ice sheet's going to melt, et cetera. And this has to do with all the complicated feedbacks, right? It's not just about the effect of CO2. It's the effect of CO2 and then what happens, right? And then all the positive and negative feedbacks. Oh, and then there's, you know, decreased cloud cover, and there's the decreased, you know, albedo from the ice melting, and then there's more water in the heat in the ocean. And
right, Steve, if we have decreased libido, that means we won't have as many babies.
That's right.
I didn't know that global warming affected that.
It could. It could. It could affect libido and albedo. So...
You say libido.
Essentially, though, the data that we've collected over the last 50 years has narrowed the range, and now it's more like, it's going to be between more like 2.5 to 3.5. So it really is maybe 4, maybe like, so it is really coming in the middle of the range.
That's great.
That we thought, it's not like shifting to one side or the other. It's,
crushing into the center.
You know, the peak of that curve where we thought it was going to be, we're narrowing it in on both sides. So it's probably not going to be 6 degrees, but it's definitely, you know, not going to be 1 degree. If you go like the 2 standard deviation thing, like 97.5%, what it's going to be, or 95%, it's going to be somewhere between like 2.5 and 4 degrees warming. And then even at that low end, so we'd say even at the low end of the 2 standard deviation, like probability range, 2.5 degrees warming at doubling of CO2, which we're definitely going to hit, by the way, the doubling of the CO2. Really bad stuff happens, right? Because then you have the domino effect
of
tipping points, you know, where the feedback loops change. You get changes in the feedback loops. And so the real question is, let's say we double our CO2 from pre-industrial levels, or whatever, you know, some number, and then we stop net CO2 production, you know, not net, no new net greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Where is the new equilibrium point going to be established, right? Where are we going to settle in once everything, all the feedback loops work their way out, the new homeostasis, where are we going to land? Where is that going to be?
But isn't that a moving target? Because we're not like stabilizing the damage that we've done. We're increasing it.
I'm just saying if we did stabilize it, if we did like shut off any new production. And so that's we don't know the precise answer to that. There's still a range of what that would be. And that range can still be pretty big because we don't know like what where the tipping points are. And so the concern is like if we get to 2 degrees, if we get to 2 degrees warming, which is at the low end of the climate sensitivity graph, right? Mm-hmm. That getting to 2 degrees by putting CO2 in the atmosphere might get us all the way to 6 degrees.
Oof.
Because of other tipping points.
Oh, boy.
And so it may take 1,000 years to get there. I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but in 1,000 years, that may be the climate that we... you know, bequeath to the earth, to human civilization going forward. And it may be irreversible on human civilization timescales. You know, like if we lose the Antarctic ice sheet, that takes millions of years to reproduce.
But couldn't we just use absolute zero to redo it?
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I know you're joking, but the real question is, can we technology our way out of this? You know, is there any...
Yes.
Like in 100 years or in 500 years, are we going to be able to grow 2 million years of ice in a decade and sort of reestablish our pre-industrial climate? And of course, nobody knows. Although I don't think it's a good idea to count on that.
No, I shouldn't count on it. But I mean,
that seems
geoengineering.
Pretty, yeah, but that's where you know,
$2 a bag.
Extreme
that's expensive.
Geoengineering is not a good plan.
No, that shouldn't be your fallback.
That's not your plan.
But in 500.
But it kind
years,
of is our fallback right now. That's
it
the
is,
problem.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
That's
all. Yeah.
So, but I guess the bottom line of all of this is that our confidence in what climate sensitivity is getting greater.
Yeah.
And we're narrowing the uncertainty over time. And so you don't listen to climate change deniers when they say, oh, no, they're wrong about climate sensitivity. And they'll cherry pick some paper by some guy, some outlier. He'll say it's really 1 or 1.5 or whatever. Systematic reviews of multiple independent lines of evidence, multiple different models are pretty much agreeing very solidly. And this recent paper that we're talking about reaffirms that to a higher degree of confidence. Mm-hmm. No, it's going to be in the middle of that range, that 2.5 to 4 degree range, somewhere in there. And that is absolutely where very bad things happen. When are we going to hit that doubling? It depends. It's probably going to be by the end of the century. We're going to hit that doubling. And it's probably not going to be pretty. All right, Evan.
We're moving on to this.
These pictures are telling a very important science story. Tell us about it.
An important science story, because what you're seeing there is, well, copies of copies of copies, and it's being touted as different science. We've talked about this before, actually. A Chinese company has produced at least 400 fake science articles by design.
Whoa.
And again, this is a subject we've talked about before on the show about these fake publications. And what they do here is these Chinese companies are actually, they pinpointed it primarily to one Chinese company, which they frankly didn't name in this particular article. But what they do is they will take these Western blot patterns and just use them in over and over again. And they'll make maybe slight modifications. They'll make little changes. They'll flip things around. They'll invert them. But they're basically putting out false information as part of these science research papers that are then being accepted by journals and being printed in some that are, not all junk journals. Some of them actually have credibility and are used. What's interesting about this is that the article went on to explain exactly who is responsible for making this discovery. And you would think that, okay, so the researchers and the journals and academics and other people, they know this is happening. So perhaps they're the backbone. They're the reasons why they're the force behind figuring out that, that was China and the methods used. Well, that's not true. It's actually a handful of people, basically, who all but quit their careers in doing other science work so that they could devote themselves full time, sometimes for little pay, sometimes for no pay at all, in order to do the work to have figured out that these are phony. This appeared in the website Science Norway, and it was talked about in the magazine Research Ethics. And the author went on to interview a couple of these people, one of which goes by the moniker Morty. And they're using the moniker because, they have to protect themselves because they're still doing other science research and things. And they fear repercussions and other things. He says that the situation is unclear. What we believe we have found so far is only a small part of a comprehensive, systematic falsification of research literature. He and his team have been working on this since 2013 and have discovered in this particular case hundreds of cases of actual fraud that is occurring.
And we talked about a similar situation previously where this is separate from this, but there was a one lab in China where you have a professor who's the head of a lab. And
is it Wuhan?
No. There's many, many, people working underneath him producing lots, like 20, 30 papers, a lot of papers per year. Mm-hmm. But he's like the last author, the senior author on all the paper. And there was massive fraud of exactly this kind where and it wasn't just Western blots. This is just one type of picture. Anything where there's a picture involved,
right?
And it could be a pathology slide. There's other kinds of tests like this where you're looking at
cells,
cells, or DNA fragments or different sorts of things. And where they found proof of fabrication, where they, for example, they might flip an image or use pieces of an image. Like, you know how you could tell if it's been duplicated, because there's little tiny details that are exactly the same, and it should never be that way. Yeah. You know, it's not just like, they're not just similar. It's a copy. You can prove it's fraud. And that professor just basically threw his own people under the bus and didn't even take responsibility for it, which is despicable. But here's the thing. This is fabrication, you know, of data, you know, scientific fraud, not mistakes, not sloppy methodology,
errors, right. They knew what they were
doing. Not bias. This is fabrication.
It's intentional.
Absolutely.
On a massive scale. And we're detecting it in those papers where it's easiest to detect, because there's a smoking gun picture involved. So what about the scientific papers where there's just numbers on a page? Like, it's just, there is no picture. There is no similar sort of smoking gun evidence, or it's harder. You can't detect it, but it's more statistical and it's a little bit harder to demonstrate. You know, are we to believe that that's all good, you know, because we can't see the picture?
I think in some ways, that's what the replication crisis is showing us, right? So
partly
trying to replicate such studies, and realizing that either the data set is opaque and we can't, you know, these scientists who are now from a completely different field, a completely different university, whatever, are trying to do something similar. And they're like, we're not getting the same results as you. Why is that? Yeah. That's when a lot of these retractions come out.
Right.
They're known as paper mills, these companies out of China that are actually doing this. And what has happened is that they've become aware of this team of independent scientists who have, again, put aside their careers in order to pursue this full time, to try to expose this fraud. They realize what they're doing. So what do the China paper mills do? They double down on their efforts. They don't try to either correct their ways or admit guilt or culpability or anything at all. They adopt new techniques, harder techniques, to try to perpetrate the same fraud that's going on. Fortunately, these dedicated people who know what they're looking at, and it does take a trained eye in order to be able to look at something like this and see exactly what is going on here. Fortunately, they're still able to kind of keep a little bit ahead of the curve and still make identify papers and graphics and other charts and things that have been manipulated. In fact, there's one person as part of this article, and she says in her career she's probably looked and identified as many as 60,000 images, individual images that have been manipulated in some way, and she's been doing that for the better part of 7 years now.
Yeah. And again, not to pick on China, because this can happen anywhere, but there does seem to be a disproportionate problem there.
Yeah.
And there's other lines of evidence for that, too. Like, I've talked about the fact previously that 100% of acupuncture studies coming out of China are positive, which is impossible, even if acupuncture does work, and I don't think it does.
Right.
And if you look at the research in the rest of the world, it shows that it does not work. And yet we have this positive studies coming, you know, consistently, unbelievably coming out of China, which then contaminates every systematic review.
Yeah.
And it's a problem, you know, and I think it's all fake, in my opinion. I think that there's no reason to accept it. The statistical analysis tells us it's probably not real.
Right.
And now it's happening in this context of now multiple stories about extensive fabrication.
Why are they doing
it? It's a cultural problem in China.
What's the profit?
They get paid to generate the products.
The products that then relate to the studies that they've done. So
well, like Steve was talking about with the acupuncture, it's cultural nationalism. Like, it's promoting an entire industry.
There's a lot of pressure, not only to produce positive findings to advance your career, but to prove that your culture is correct.
Yeah.
Right. And so that pressure is immense.
And they invented, you know, ancient Chinese medicine.
Right.
And you know, not that long ago.
It's a fabrication. Yeah. It's all fabrication.
Right, the whole thing's
fabric. All right. We're going to move on, Evan.
Yep.
Carrie, you got 10 minutes for your news item.
Yes. I could probably do it quicker.
All
set
right,
a timer
quicker
for me. All right. Deep sea anglerfish. We've heard of them. They're scary looking. They've got the big chompers. They've got the cool light lure.
The glow in the dark.
But did you know, there's a couple of things I wanted to introduce before we get into the meat of this. Did you know that there are
delicious
something like Did you know they're delicious? Did you know that there are something like 300 different species of anglerfish?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And they're not all...
I thought it was 298. You know,
they all look pretty different. There's some in shallow water. There's some in deep water. The deep sea species are about 160. And then there's a really weird behavior that happens in about 25 of them. And we're actually viewing it in this image right now. That behavior is a really bizarre sexual dimorphism that also leads to something bizarre called sexual parasitism. So actually what you're looking at is a picture of a female anglerfish. And if you look at the bottom, that's a male anglerfish. See how tiny he is?
Yeah.
He's connected to the fish.
Yeah,
George, George is pointing it out for us. Thank you, George.
But Kara, is his mouth attached to her body and his tail is at the bottom?
Yes.
I think that's what we're
That's what we're looking at. So in about 25 of these species, there's a bite fuse to mate behavior. And the male species actually, this is the only, these 25 species of anglerfish are the only animals known to science where the male and female of the species fuse together permanently as a function of mating.
Whoa.
This is really cool. And he actually does interesting things. Like he loses his eyes. You don't need him anymore. He loses some of his fins. They start to degrade because he doesn't need them anymore. He no longer needs to search for food.
That was amazing. Careful, George.
I don't know, Kara. Couples like that.
Right. It's really – so the cool thing is we've known for some time – that these deep sea anglerfish, these male anglerfish don't really have a lot of like adaptive capabilities. We also know that it's very barren in these deep parts of the ocean. And so estimates are that only something like 1% of the males of the species will ever actually come across the mate and be able to fuse. In some select subspecies, they also will have multiple males that will fuse to them. In some, it's only a single male.
A little harem.
Yeah, it's interesting. And of course, the mating ritual occurs via like these hormonal shifts. And so the eggs being fertilized is actually occurring within the female. And this is, like I said, a lifetime fusion. She doesn't absorb him. He just stays there as a sexual parasite. That's what they call it. There are a lot of super interesting components about how, like, the lure, you know, the bacterial bioluminescent lure, which is used to help bait fish, to lure fish to them. It can also be used for mating. So apparently the males of the species, if you see them up close, there's not a lot going on. They're these tiny little fish with little chompers, but they have massive nostrils. I think they have the largest nostril to head ratio of any animal. Wow. And they can pick up on the scents that the females give off, and they can look for very specific patterns of these light displays that say, oh, that's a female of my specific species. Because remember, there's 300 species, and then they'll be able to latch on to her. But that's not the news item. The news item is here is probably the question that some of you may be thinking. How does the female not reject the male? Like from an immunological perspective, we know that as human beings, if we are going to do some sort of organ transplant, not only do you have to make sure that the tissue is a really perfect match, you still usually or always have to use immunosuppressant drugs in order for the person not to reject the donated tissue. Right? You've also got situations where if the Rh factor is different between mom and baby, mom might actually reject baby during her pregnancy. Rejection of foreign tissue is a really important function of the immune system. But anglerfish, we've finally figured out how anglerfish
do it.
So they do have an immune system. If they didn't have an immune system, they would be so...
Toast.
Yeah, they would die. They would die quickly. There are pathogens in the deep ocean. And remember, some of these little suckers fly up or swim up farther to the surface. So
yeah,
there
I thought the pathogens would be too afraid of the anglerfish because it's so freaky looking. I mean, right? If I was a pathogen, like, I'm staying away from that.
Of course, yeah. So we do have two different types of immune system. And I feel like we've talked a little bit about this recently on the show. So do you remember what the context was, Steve? Was it this week or last week?
It was about resistance to COVID.
Yeah. Right, COVID resistance. You're right. So... We have an innate immune system, and we also have an adaptive immune system, and all vertebrates have this. So the innate immune system are these quick responses like barriers, physical barriers, mucous membranes, different types of chemicals, hair, skin, and even cell types like macrophages. So these are things where it's like, I don't want this pathogen near me. I'm going to keep it out. I'm going to not even let it get close to me. But then certain pathogens will invade, and then we have an adaptive immune system, and that's our body's capability to do different types of gene expression in order to produce things like T cells or specific antibodies that are custom, you know, developed by our bodies to try and fight off pathogens. So the interesting thing here is that in the two different types of parasitic relationships that the researchers studied within anglerfish, they found two different genetic changes. So there are certain types of anglerfish for which the male attaches temporarily. This picture is actually really cool because this shows those nostrils. This is the male. Yeah. Okay. See how different it is? It's a tiny little fish and it's really up close. It has big, big eyes and massive nostrils. So, cause its whole life goal is to find a mate. It's like, it's only got to survive long enough to find a mate. And then she does all the heavy lifting. She feeds for him. She breathes for him. Her heart beats for him.
Yeah, that's the relationship I'm looking for.
Right. Look at that. So, but here's the interesting thing. It turns out that they have an innate immune system. They've got the physical barriers. They've got the mucous membranes. They've got the, you know, the fins, everything, not the fins, the scales, everything that they need to fight off barrier type infections. And then we've got these two kind of versions of our adaptive immune system, the T cells and the antibody responses. And here's a really cool thing. They found that in the species of anglerfish, where the males attach temporarily but then detach, they're missing one of those gene pathways. And in the species where the males attach permanently, they're missing both of the pathways that are involved in this immune response. So this happens on the AICDA gene. I don't know if we generally pronounce that ACTA or ASTA, but that's the activation-induced cytidine deaminase. And then it also happens in RAG genes, recombination activating genes. So the RAG genes are responsible for encoding T receptor molecules and like T lymphocytes for immunoglobulin, and the ACTA are responsible for developing certain types of antibodies. And what we find is that in the organisms for which there's a permanent fusion, they're missing both adaptive pathways. Yeah. In the ones where there's a temporary, they're missing one. But here's the cool thing. Biologists have long thought that you can't disentangle the innate immune system from the adaptive immune system. And now that we know that in anglerfish, they've silenced certain genes or lost certain genes over time that are responsible for the adaptive immune system, but they still have a functional innate immune system, now we might be able to eventually use some of that knowledge to improve the way that we help immunodeficient patients and also patients who need like organ and bone marrow and blood transfusions and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Because if we can boost their innate immune system but repress their adaptive immune system, they may fare better during these different types of treatments.
Wow. Cool.
Wow.
Super cool. Well,
yeah,
super
love it.
Cool. Right.
I love those fish.
Basically, anything they're you so think cool. of as a species is actually a genus with lots of different individual species.
Totally, yeah. 300. Yeah, 300.
All right. Oh, my gosh. Kara said 300 in the right way. That's awesome.
15 minutes until the game show. Yeah, so we're going to cut right to science or fiction.
Whoa.
It's time for science or fiction.
Evan, you ready?
There's a theme for science or fiction.
Of course there is.
If I need to explain the rules to everyone, two of these items are going to be real. One is delicious. And it's up to the panel. It's up to George. It's up to Kara. It's up to you, the viewer at home, to figure out which one is the fake. And the theme is masks.
Masks.
Oh, masks.
Halloween masks?
Oh, masks.
All kinds of masks.
All kinds of masks. Anything having to do with a mask are the three items for this week.
All right, let's do it.
All right. Number one. The oldest masks discovered were found in modern-day Israel, and they date back to pre-biblical times. They are roughly 9,000 years old. Number two, in the 14th century, plague doctors wore a mask with a bird-like beak to protect them from the Black Plague, as they believed diseases of the time could be caught from breathing bad air. Number three, In 2021, it is estimated that U.S. manufacturers will collectively produce over 1 billion N95 masks. We start here, because there's no way to poll the audience.
That's right.
So we just got to do it ourselves.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Why don't we start with Kara all the way?
No.
Scotland.
All right. I'm going to try and work through these quickly. The oldest mask discovered in modern day Israel, dating back pre-biblical. So 9,000 years is really pre-biblical. And, you know, I have a friend who grew up in Israel. She spent time on her dad's kibbutz and they would find things like Neanderthal hand axes there. So it's not that hard for me to believe that there would be ancient relics there. But the question is, could a mask survive? Because it's usually going to be like fabric, but maybe it'll be wood. Okay. 14th century plague doctors wearing bird-like masks. Well, we know plague masks. We've seen them before. Was it to protect them? I don't know. Was it actually to say, I'm a plague doctor? Maybe that was what they were about. I do think that people thought that there was like miasma, but I also think that they had some idea of the plague. Maybe. I mean, this was in like bloodletting era. Medieval medicine was sort of on point and sort of like, what are you even talking about? And then 2021, it's estimated that U.S. manufacturers will produce over 1 billion N95s. I don't know. It's so random. I mean, I know in 2020, I don't think we made that many. I think we're mostly importing them. Maybe the idea is to keep with the importation chain, but I also know that Trump is like really not hot on China right now. So maybe we're going to see a big change in supply chains. So they could all be science and they could all be fiction.
That is the point. Yep.
Yeah, I'm leaning towards the Israel one because I wonder if the masks could have survived. But I'm also kind of leaning towards the plague doctor one because that's like the one that seems like the duh obvious, but maybe there's something we don't understand. Maybe the plague masks actually weren't there to protect the doctors, but they were more of a signal function. So I don't know. I'm going to go against my better judgment and go with the plague mask being the fiction.
Okay. Plague masks, fiction. Bob.
Yeah. Kara said a lot of good stuff there that I agree with. I went to a museum that had a big display about the pandemic from 1918. And I've got this fuzzy false memory probably of those plague masks that they thought may have protected the doctor. So I'm gonna go with that. And the bad air miasma thing, that's definitely in my brain somewhere. So that one I think is probably good, maybe good. The third one, the 1 billion N95 masks, I mean, yeah, it's certainly possible if we put our minds to it. I've got a problem with the first one as well, the masks from 9,000 years ago. I have a lot of masks. I collect masks. And sure, they're latex, and they didn't have latex 9,000 years ago, but they don't last very long. I've got plenty that I just can't wear them anymore. So I'm gonna go from that completely probably unrelated factoid from my life and say that one's probably fiction too.
Great. Okay. Then we're going to throw it to Steve.
Yeah, it's a good argument because I can make an argument for and against each of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the N95 masks are the ones that block 95% of the virus coming in. Everyone doesn't need to wear them. You need to wear them if you're definitely being exposed. So, you know, a billion's a lot. And again, I think the question there for me is it in the U.S. or is it going to be outside the U.S. where the majority of them are going to be manufactured? So if that's the fiction, it's because it's not going to be in the U.S., again, the second one, yeah, we all have seen those masks, the bird-like masks. Those were the plague masks. So that part is definitely true. I think everybody knows that. The question is, did they believe at the time that they were protecting them? They're definitely, this was pre-germ theory, 14th century. They did think it was bad air, but I don't know if there might be a cultural reason for those masks that didn't have to do with the idea that they were being protected. And the first one I have a problem with too, because my thinking is the opposite from Bob's, in that I think that they may be older than that. I would say masks are almost definitely older than 9,000 years and culturally. The question is though, would they have survived? Do we have examples of like the oldest masks known or found? So if there were wooden masks, for example, would they have not lasted long enough for us to find? So, you know, 9,000 years for the oldest known evidence of masks is not unreasonable, but still, I still just think there might be something older than that. So Again, I could go.
Put your nickel down.
Any of these, but I think I'm going to say that I'm going to go with the masks being the old, the 9,000-year-old Israeli masks, because I think there may have been something older than that.
So you agree with Bob on that one?
No, Bob went with
number two, right?
You went with the 9,000-year-old Egyptian.
Oh, you did just for the opposite reason as me.
Correct.
Yeah. Kara, well, yeah.
Right.
Kara so
yeah,
far
I'm
has
out
chosen.
On a limb here.
But yeah, Kara did the bad air. Okay.
Jay, or wherever Jay is. Jay, you're next.
Yeah. All right, so I'll take these in reverse order. I absolutely believe that U.S. manufacturers will produce a billion N95 masks. You know, I know that the country can do it. Just I think it's being done deliberately because we didn't have a direct supply chain for those products. Because I think they were being made in China, and I think that Trump wants the U.S. to make them. So I think that was science. The second one, absolutely. Plague doctors wore bird-like masks. They wore them because that the beak of the mask, they would put like citrus fruit in there to prevent the bad smell of the plague. The question is, were they blocking the bad smell, or did they think it was bad air? I do think that one is
could
science.
Could be both. Could be.
I think that one is science. I think that because I know that those masks exist. I know that they were putting in there to get rid of the scent. They would put fruit in them, and I do think that they believed it was bad air, quote unquote bad air. The first one, yeah, I agree with Steve. I think that masks were found to be much older than 9,000 years old. So I will count number one as the fake.
All right, George, you've heard everyone else. Later
yeah, I'm going to say the 9,000-year-old is correct. That seems right to me. Also, I'm going to go with the malodorous air, the miasma bad air thing I think is true. I think that the production of masks is going to be significantly greater than a billion masks. Uh-huh. So that's my guess, is that number is incorrect. Maybe it's too low, maybe it's too high, but I think that number is incorrect. So I'm thinking number three, the N95 masks is the fiction.
Okay, George says N95 masks are fiction. Kara, you believe that our friends wearing the bird-like beak masks is the fiction. And the novella trio says it is the 9,000-year-old masks from Israel that is the fiction. So we're all over the map here. How should we do this? Should we take them in order?
You decide. No,
why not?
Game master.
Number one, the oldest masks discovered were found in modern-day Israel, and they date back to pre-biblical times. They are roughly 9,000 years old. This one is science.
Oy,
damn. It is science. Steve, you had some really good points there, and specifically about
masks
being older.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the researchers believe that, yes, there definitely were older masks. There's just none that can be found because of what Kara said. The material itself breaks down over time,
but not
when they're made of stone.
Yeah.
When they're actually carved from stone, they will last. Sure. And these are the ones that they found. They're made from stone.
Cool. Oh,
and they're pretty
stone masks.
Sound inconvenient to wear.
Yeah, you know, but they had like extra holes and things on the sides of them, and they were kind of wondering what they were for. They believe that it was for the strap holes, so you could strap it on. You put enough straps through it that it could hold on to your face.
And that's where the phrase "stone face" comes from.
I have no idea, but it may as well have been. And I've got
these kids are so confused.
That famous Israeli phrase.
All right, we're gonna. All right, so it's down to the last two. George versus Kara, here. Number two, in the 14th century, plague doctors wore a mask with a bird-like beak to protect them from the Black Plague, as they believed diseases of the time could be caught from breathing bad air. Kara, you believe this one is the fiction. George, you think it's science. This one is. The fiction.
Oh,
this is the fiction.
Nicely done.
Yeah. So here's
probably for the wrong reason, right?
Nicely done.
Maybe. Now I don't know if it was for the wrong reason or not. But all the points that were brought up were effectively correct. Jay, a lot of points you brought up were correct. They would stuff a bunch of spices and other things in there to protect them from the decay, smells, and the awful things that they would have to encounter. However, it was not the 14th century, and it was not the Black Plague. Nope, it happened afterwards. It happened in the 17th century is where they attribute the doctor who invented that mask, a French doctor.
I totally didn't even think of that.
I thought about it, but
Charles Delorme.
He swayed me on.
So was it another, because I know the plague came back multiple times, or was it a different disease altogether?
It was a different one, but it was not the Black Plague, not the one that killed 200 million people. But it's often attributed to the Black Plague.
That's the most famous plague.
Amazing. Exactly. You know what, Evan? I feel like I'm dialed into this one because I just finished reading Albert Camus' The Plague, which is an incredible book, you guys. You have to read it. And they don't really talk about plague masks or anything, but I've had plague on the mind for like the past 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh. So you had a distinct advantage for this one this week, Kara. And jumping quickly to the last one, 2021, George, yes, the United States manufacturing companies are going to produce over 1 billion of these masks. Pre-COVID, U.S. manufacturers were churning out about 50 million a year. It was pre-COVID. In the 90 days at the height of COVID, March, April, May, U.S. manufacturers produced 140 million. So they really ramped it up, and it's being ramped up even more. And yes, 2021, there will be at least 1 billion of these masks made by U.S. companies.
Well, all right. So, apparently the people in the chat are enormously congratulating Kara, which I find
for her solo win.
Yeah, like good job, Kara. I thought George was going to. You came so close to almost winning, George.
That's the story of my life. That's the story of my life. I come so close to almost winning.
I went first. It is not easy.
Yeah, I mean, Kara, you really killed it this time. All right, so a couple things, guys, before we close it out.
I have one question. One question from the chat that I think you guys could answer real quick.
Yeah.
Okay. Each of you could answer this really quick. Jason Smith says, what's your favorite movie character? Just a one word or one character answer. We're going to cycle through everybody.
Choosing your favorite
kid. Favorite movie. Just what comes to mind? Just don't even think about
it too much. Yeah, Darth Vader came to mind. Ooh. Indiana Jones.
Two Darths and Indiana
Hannibal
Jones.
Lecter.
Hannibal Lecter. Bob?
Caligula.
my second favorite.
That's also Albert Camus.
I don't know. Kara, I can't answer that question.
The Mandalorian.
It's a really hard one. I think I would have to pick my favorite movie, which is A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints. And so my favorite character would be the main character of that film. It was actually played by Shia LaBeouf, strangely, but he's incredible in it. Highly recommend the film.
What's the character's name? Do you remember?
He's Italian.
Oh, okay.
Giuseppe Pasta.
Vito Tutti.
Hannibal Lecter is a good choice.
Visto Tutti.
I remember being so impressed with that.
It's a fantastic character. Yeah. First one that came to mind. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Here's the quote. Carl Sagan always used to say that when he was trying to explain something to someone, he would go back to that time when he didn't understand it, and then he would retrace his thought steps so that he could make it absolutely clear. And that's one of the infinite number of things I learned from him.
Wow.
Andrian.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a great quote.
Great nice. And,
yeah. What a mind he had to have to be able to pull that off, because I don't remember what I had for lunch yet.
No, but I think that
and to systematically think that, to approach it that way is brilliant.
Yep.
It really is and effective.
So I do like that quote. You know, I do try to model my science teaching after that as well, because I do think that there are some people that I know that are really smart, like they're brilliant scientists, but to them, everything is so intuitive, they can't really reproduce the process they went through. So thank you all for joining us for this very special episode, the first live digital Nexus. It was a lot of fun. We always have a lot more to talk about than we have time to get to, but that's okay. There'll be more SGU shows. George, thanks for joining us. Thanks for hosting the SGU and keeping this thing glued together as, technical issues happen. Thank you guys. Kara, thanks for joining us from Scotland.
Kara. Yay!
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.